Hi, before we get to the podcast, just a short little ad here for a great, really cool event that we've got here at Texas A&M in the next few weeks that will be available for you on the web, streaming live. It's the HLKN Distinguished Lecture Series on April 7th and 8th, 2015 in Rudder Auditorium here. If you're here close, you can come see it. Our theme this year is Health, Kinesiology, and Sports Management in the SEC. Our department chair, Rick Kreider, has done a great job of lining up fabulous speakers for this. I mean, eminent scientists in so many different areas, people like Dr. Bruce Gladden, Dr. Hal Laughlin, Dr. Harold Rayner, Dr. Holly Rayner, Dr. Bob Wolf, and people like Greg Sankey, who's going to be the new commissioner of the SEC. So just Google Texas A&M, HLKNDLS, and the site will pop up, list all the speakers, list the schedule, and it will list the link that you need to hit to stream this live. So join us then. Now onto the podcast.
Welcome to the Sports Medicine Podcast, brought to you by the Sidney and J.L. Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine and Human Performance in the Department of Health and Kinesiology at Texas A&M University. At the Huffines Institute, we're always working to facilitate, apply, and bring you the most up-to-date coverage of the wide world that is sports medicine and human performance, all in a language you can understand and share with your friends. And now, here's our host, the director of the Huffines Institute, Dr. Tim Lightfoot.
Well, hello and welcome to the weekly edition of the Huffines Institute for Sports Medicine Human Performance Podcast. I'm your host, Tim Lightfoot, and I want to thank you all for taking the time to download us and to listen to us today. Our goal is to bring you an interesting individual in the world of sports medicine and human performance every week, and I think this week we have really done an admirable job. We have with us in the podcast today Dr. Wendy DeMarc Wanafried. Welcome to the podcast, Wendy.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, it's a great pleasure to have you here. I think probably you didn't know you were going to be here until 3 days ago when we...
An added bonus.
I'm going to take a few minutes and tell the audience a little bit about you and why we're excited that you're here with us. Dr. DeMarc Wanafried is actually a guest here of the Department of Nutrition here, especially Dr. Rob Chapkin. So Dr. DeMarc Wanafried is currently the Web Chair in Nutritional Sciences at the University of Alabama, Birmingham. She has a long list of accomplishments that would take us actually most of the podcast to read if we were to read it. She has a PhD in nutritional science from Syracuse University. Some of her duties at University of Alabama, Birmingham, she is the associate director of the UAB Comprehensive Cancer Center. She is a senior scientist in the UAB Center for Aging. She's a senior scientist at UAB Center for Exercise Medicine, and the list goes on and on. I don't know how you have time to do it all. Well, welcome. We're so glad to have you here.
Thank you.
So we're going to, and Wendy's here, we're going to talk a little bit about her research. She has done a tremendous amount of research focused in cancer, especially with nutrition and exercise. And we'd like to start many of these podcasts with what got you interested in this area? Did you like wake up at eight when you were 8 years old and say, you know what, I'm going to be a cancer dietetics researcher?
No, you know, I think life has a way of twisting us and turning us into different paths that we never would have thought we ever would have gone down. Mm. So, no, there wasn't any particular burning desire. I did have a cancer diagnosis when I was young, but I actually tried to get away from that rather than it spurring my research career. So after I had my cancer diagnosis, I actually went into cardiovascular care, and I did my initial research in cardiovascular care and nutrition. Some of the early studies on oat bran and hypercholesterolemia we did when I was at Syracuse University.
So. Interesting. What got you interested in the nutrition side of things?
Nutrition is one of those things. I was at the University of Michigan, and I was in the pre-med program, and it called out to me. Mm. And it took me down the road. And then I did my internship down at the Texas Medical Center and had a really good experience there and was really going to be a dietitian for the rest of my life. But as life would have it, every year I would train dietetic interns, and sooner or later I had enough credits at Syracuse University to get a doctorate. And so, yeah. Again, life has a way of taking us down interesting paths that we never would have foreseen.
Well, one of the things that we've talked about with our guest over the years is that oftentimes to be in this business, and when I say business, I mean the business of research, especially the way it is now, really takes a passion. One of the things I didn't say in your introduction is that you've had multiple millions of dollars in external funding from mm-hmm. the national government and a variety of different funding sources. Those things, especially nowadays, are not easy to maintain, easy to keep up. And so you have to have something that drives you mm-hmm. to continue this work. What do you see that drives? We're going to get into what your work actually is in a few minutes. But what do you, for those people that are listening, that are maybe your students that are thinking about this, what drives you to stay in this business, even though it's difficult?
Well, you make a good point. It is difficult. And I think since this podcast does go out to many thousands of people, I think a lot of that listening audience needs to know how dried up the federal dollars are and to really make a plea to their congressmen to expand the budget, NIH budget, because it really is dire. The medical advancements that we can make now are so constricted by the amount of funding. And so this is really, we're getting into the dark ages of medicine and the dark ages of medical research because the NIH dollars are really scaled back. So you make a good point. It's not an easy business, and it's hard, very difficult to be a researcher today. Be that as it may, I think what drives me and what I really have a passion for is to try to make life better for cancer survivors. Mm-hmm. And cancer survivors are a growing segment of our population. Right now, they will, in 2020, comprise 20 million people throughout the United States. So that segment is growing as more and more baby boomers are living longer and longer. Cancer is a disease of aging. Mm-hmm. And our treatment is better, screening is better. So more and more people are going to become cancer survivors, and we really do need programs out there because their needs are much different mm-hmm. than any other patient population.
How are their needs different?
Their needs are different because their treatment is different. For example, when people get chemotherapy, chemotherapy not only targets the cells, cancer cells, mm-hmm. but it will also target fast-growing cells or cells that have a higher metabolic rate, like muscle. Mm. And so many cancer patients develop sarcopenic obesity because the chemotherapy starts acting on their muscles, and those really do take a hit while they're under treatment. So trying to build those back up and get people active again.
It's almost muscle wasting in many cases.
Exactly. Yeah, it is. So their needs are different there. And then we're starting to learn more about metabolic needs. For example, their thyroid hormones or their ability to make various hormones may be diminished after that cancer diagnosis. Again, these are areas that we really have to target for future research.
Yeah. So a lot of your work has dealt with cancer survivors and those needs, especially with the muscle wasting or the loss of muscle mass. What's the big picture that you've got coming from your research? Tell the audience a little bit of what you're doing from your words and tell us your findings.
Well, we have a lot of obesity is a huge issue for cancer survivors, and I sit on various panels that make recommendations for cancer survivors, such as the American Cancer Society. They have recommendations for cancer survivors, and what we're trying to do is to think of innovative ways for us to intervene in that population. So what we're trying to do is to find out, one, how energy balance affects the tumor. Mm-hmm. So if we can, for example, through diet, through exercise, affect the environment that the tumor lives in, maybe what we can do is use diet and exercise as an adjunctive treatment mm-hmm. for cancer. Mm-hmm. So as far as an adjunctive therapy goes, I think we really are at the cusp of learning how we really need to intervene with exercise, mm-hmm. how we need to intervene with diet. And there's a lot of strides to be made. So, for example, for exercise, I know you have a huge center here for mm-hmm. exercise. As far as the trainers that work with cancer survivors, to really to get their muscle mass back to where it was at baseline through a lot of strength training exercise, as well as to help them burn off those extra calories, because we know that obesity is a poor prognostic factor for cancer. Mm-hmm. A lot of people don't know that. A lot of people think, "Oh, I'm gonna have cancer. I'm gonna become wasted. So I better start eating now." Well, that's the exact opposite of what you should do. We know that tumors love to be fed, so they grow like crazy. And we have to make a concerted effort not to feed that process. So a lot of our research efforts now are focused on, well, what is that contribution? Can we really stop that cancer cell, or not stop, maybe perhaps slow it down from growing as fast through diet and exercise? And what regimens are those? The other thing that we're doing is we just do some general lifestyle things for cancer survivors. Two of the grants that we have right now are gardening interventions. Mm. What we do is we pair master gardeners through the cooperative extension with a cancer survivor. And the master gardener leads that cancer survivor through a year of gardening.
Wow.
Because I am located in Alabama, much like Texas, it has three growing seasons. I guess it depends on what area of Texas you're from. I realize that Texas is a lot bigger than Alabama.
We have warm, really hot, and hot.
Yeah. So the cooperative extension, there are offices everywhere, and they're fantastic. And so what we're doing in Alabama is we're pairing a master gardener with a cancer survivor, again, leading them through a year of gardening, vegetable gardening, and then launching that cancer survivor so that they can maintain that garden, hopefully, for the rest of their life. And what we're finding is that gardening experience, when we first initiated it, we thought that it would really improve fruit and vegetable consumption because, of course, the survivor is growing vegetables in their garden, some fruit. What we're finding is that it not only improves the fruit and vegetable consumption, it improves physical activity because once the cancer survivor goes out there and picks their tomato, generally speaking, they putz around in their yard. They decide to go for a walk. So you all of a sudden we're seeing, even though we're not really emphasizing physical activity, they are more physically active. And then as a result of the improved diet and in physical activity, their physical functioning improves dramatically. Mm-hmm. And that's really important for cancer survivors that are 65 and older because generally speaking, when a person's diagnosed with cancer and they're 40 years old, they are pretty resilient. They get over it. They get back to where they need to be. The older you get, the more of a hit you take. Mm. A lot of times, people that are 65 and older become incapacitated, unable to live independently. And that's when healthcare costs really escalate.
Go up, right.
So for this fairly low-tech intervention, we're seeing huge benefit, and so it's really quite exciting.
It's almost like you're giving them an excuse to go outside, and once they're outside, then they decide, well, it's okay, I'll stay and do some other things.
Yeah, it's kind of a behavioral cue, and then when we leave, when we're done with our intervention, we leave the cancer survivor with all their equipment, their raised bed or their earth boxes, whatever we have provided for them during that time of the intervention. So they have that. Yeah. They can keep on going.
Do they adhere pretty much once your intervention is done? Do they continue?
Surprisingly, yes. All of our patients that have been on this program have, when we ask them, okay, are you going to garden? Do you plan to garden the next year? All of them, 100% say, yes, I'm going to garden. And then 50% of them say, I'm expanding my garden next year.
Wow.
Another very good metric of our success is that some of our cancer survivors that have participated in this program have then enrolled in the cooperative extension to become a master gardener. Because master gardeners, depending upon the state that you live in, will have to go anywhere from 50 hours to 100 hours of training to become a master gardener. Mm. And then in order to maintain that certification, at least in our state, they have to donate then 50 hours a year. So we have this self-sustaining program here. So it's terrific.
Well, that's really neat to give them the opportunity to do something like that, which makes them do other or helps them do other things, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
So like that.
Yeah.
Let's loop back a little bit to the nutritional side of things. We've had several investigators on the podcast, Mick Deutz, Marielle England, actually recently talked about their work with protein, increased protein uptake in cancer patients. Have y'all done any work in that, or what's your take on that whole line of that whole work area of work?
Yeah. Well, we talked about the sarcopenic obesity here. Cancer survivors do have a protein need of 1.3 to 1.4 grams per kilogram.
And that's generally elevated, though, over the general populace. What's recommended for protein intake for general
usually
population?
Usually like 0.8. Yeah. So it is a little bit higher. You know, most Americans do consume more protein than they need. So depending upon what kind of diet that you're used to will really depend on whether that's going to be an increase or a decrease or it just stays constant.
Yeah.
It's an area of investigation.
So one of the things that we've been interested in, and we've noticed from your background, you've been doing some flaxseed trials.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us a little bit about that. Tell the general audience what flaxseed is, where we get it from, and kind of how those outcomes have been.
So flaxseed is a cold weather crop. Mm. It is not grown in Texas. It is grown in Montana and Canada primarily. The reason why we got interested in it is that it has a very high lignin content. Mm. The lignin content of flaxseed is 800 times more than any other food that we really do know about. And then it also has omega-3 fatty acids, kind of the same kind of fatty acids that you would have in fish oil. Except that it's alpha-linolenic acid as opposed to the fatty acids that are in fish. So your body is not where you can really use the fish oil, the eicosapentaenoic acid and the docosahexaenoic acid, more efficiently. Your body has to convert the alpha-linolenic acid. And for years it was thought, well, there's a problem with that. And I have a postdoc, her name is Maria Azrad, and she's been doing quite a bit of work in this area and has used the data from our previous trials to really kind of investigate, well, what's happening here? As it turns out, there are some polymorphisms that exist in this metabolic pathway, and some people can metabolize this alpha-linolenic acid to a much greater degree than others. And that's, I'm thinking, where the crux of the problem is. For years, flaxseed is controversial because some studies have suggested that high levels of alpha-linolenic acid in the diet could be harmful.
Hmm.
For example, in the Harvard newsletter, they put out a Harvard newsletter many, many years ago that suggested that men that have any sort of family history of prostate cancer or that have prostate cancer, that they not consume alpha-linolenic acid because when they started to look at the alpha-linolenic acid levels in the blood, they found that the men that were predisposed had higher levels.
Hmm.
So they kind of connected those two simple dots and then made this recommendation. As it turns out, as in most things in life, it's not
that easy.
It's not that easy. Yeah.
No.
And so
especially when it relates to science. Yeah.
Yeah. So what we're finding with this new research is that it isn't that easy. And as it turns out, there are men that are able to metabolize alpha-linolenic acid. And for those men, they seem to do just fine with levels. So they could eat all the flaxseed and all the walnuts they want. And then for this small subset of men, that is comprised of about 10% from what we've seen in our samples, that there is some problem. And that's probably what the Harvard researchers have uncovered and unfortunately have made a blanket statement to the whole population.
Is there a test that someone can take to find out if they can metabolize?
You know, right now, not commercially available. Mm. You know, we've found this out on a research basis. And as it turns out, when we look at our men and the men that participate in our studies, of course, they're scheduled for surgery. So we're able to take a look at their prostates and find out, well, how much alpha-linolenic acid is in their prostate as compared to other fatty acids. And so we really are, this is fairly new research. So Maria published her article, I think, a couple of years ago, and hopefully we'll get some funding. We talked about funding earlier in the hour. I really do hope that she's able to secure some funding to find out the answer to this very interesting question. Yeah, so we embarked upon our interest in flaxseed because of the it has the lignin, it has the alpha-linolenic acid. And we did enough pre-surgical studies. We did some work in cell culture. We did some work in animal models. Then did some small-scale pilot studies and found that the flaxseed was helpful for these men and resulted in slower tumor growth. Then we did a phase 2 trial with 161 men and, again, found that the men that got flaxseed, and they were consuming 3 tablespoons of flaxseed a day, the proliferation rate of their tumors was far less than the men that weren't consuming it.
Wow.
So, yeah, so that was very exciting, except that there was this, subset of men that really didn't respond. So.
Right. And it's not, before we leave that topic, it's not unusual that there are metabolic pathways that work in some people and not others. Maybe people don't know, but it's fairly well known that most of us could not metabolize lactose in milk until the last, 8,000 years or so.
Yeah.
And that has been a genetic change that has happened.
Yeah, so this is an area where, we really do need to find out more, and that's why personalized medicine not only is important for when we're talking about drugs and that sort of thing and making sure that people have the right genetic background in order to take the drug and for it to be effective, but the same thing goes with diet and exercise as well.
Yeah. Well, Wendy, we're running out of time. Okay. I feel like we just scratched the surface of all the things that we could talk about. Thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule to be with us today.
Thank you.
We've enjoyed it.
Pleasure to be here.
As we do with all of our guests at this time, we're going to give you a chance to kind of have the last word. What's your take-home message for anyone listening to this podcast? If they remembered nothing else from this podcast, what would you want them to remember?
Okay. Well, that's a good question. And because I do serve on these guideline panels for cancer survivors, I think it's important to put out the message that what we know, if people are cancer survivors, that watching their weight is very important. Getting some exercise is very important. 150 minutes a week is what we recommend. And then consuming diets that are fairly low in energy, and so lots of fruits and vegetables, lower in fats and sugars, is kind of the recipe for health.
Fabulous. Great take-home message. Again, thank you for being here today.
Thank you.
I enjoyed having you here.
Okay.
And I would like to thank all of you for taking the time to download and listen to us today. As regular listeners of the program know, this is the time that we have the podcast question of the week, and here with the podcast question of the week.
What type of recreational activity was prescribed to cancer survivors to provide health benefits?
Well, that was a great podcast question, Aylin. Send an email to huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu, and you'll win one of those nifty podcast T-shirts that we have. And don't ever hesitate to send us in the answer if you think you know it. So again, I want to thank our guests, and thank you all for being with us and listening. And we hope you download us next week when we'll have another interesting person from the world of sports medicine and human performance. And until then, we want you to stay active and healthy.
The Sports Medicine Podcast is produced by Aidlet Letzinger and licensed by the Huffines Institute at Texas A&M under a Creative Commons 3.0 license. You can share it as much as you want, and you can talk or blog about it all you want. Just don't change it or charge money for it. This podcast is made possible by support from the Omar Smith family and the Sydney and J.L. Huffines family. Our music was composed, performed, and graciously provided by Dave Zeltner Productions, your source for quality music and music production since 1992. Find them at www.davidzeltner.com. Our opening and closing credits were provided by johnmilesproductions.com. If you have questions or comments, please send them to huffinespodcast@hlkn.tamu.edu. From all of us at the Huffines Institute, we hope you have an active and healthy week.